This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with litigator and author Andrea Ritchie about her work challenging abusive policing against women, girls, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons of color.
If she were the advisor to New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, what would she tell him?
We'll learn how an educational panel on Palestine at Harvard Law School has elicited a controversy.
The white shoe law firm of Milbank, Tweed & Hawley, which represents Fortune 500 companies, had given $1 million to Harvard for student programs. But when they found out the program was about the denial of international law to Palestinians in Israel, they threatened to withdraw the money.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
I'm Catherine Franke. I'm a law professor at Columbia Law School, and I chair the board at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Attorney Andrea Ritchie has dedicated the past two decades to challenging abusive and discriminatory policing against women, girls, and lesbian and gay, bisexual, and transgender people of color. An accomplished litigator, she is a highly respected commentator and right now a Soros Fellow on policy reforms and litigation strategies addressing the ways in which discriminatory policing impacts women of color. Ritchie is the co-author of Queer Injustice, The Criminalization of LGBT People in the United States. It was published in 2011. And also of Caught in the Net, a report on women and the so-called war on drugs. She works closely with a range of local and national organizations, including Streetwise and SAFE, an organization focused on policing of LGBT youth of color, and is a member of Incite. She's also closely involved in Say Her Name, a gender-inclusive racial justice movement that campaigns against police brutality and violence against Black women. It aims to highlight the gender-specific ways in which police brutality and racist violence disproportionately affect Black women, especially Black queer women and Black trans women. Andrea, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to be here with you all.
It's hard to believe it's been about 5 years since we talked about Queer Injustice.
Exactly. We just actually, February 15th was the official fifth birthday of Queer Injustice. And we were sort of reflecting, actually recently in a piece on Truth Out, about its continued relevance, particularly as we're in the midst of a national conversation around mass incarceration and racial profiling and policing, and hoping that new audiences find the information there useful.
We wanted to catch up with your work. You're now a Soros Fellow. What are you doing there?
I've had the great good fortune of being a Soros Justice Fellow since November of 2014, and it's really been an opportunity to build on my work over kind of the past two decades around policing and profiling and criminalization and police brutality against women of color, queer and not queer, trans and not trans. But that's actually sort of my original body of work that sort of focused on LGBT folks for the last few years, but really my longest standing work has been around documenting women of color's experiences of policing, thinking about the ways in which women of color experience policing in ways that are similar to other members of their communities, and then also the ways in which we experience policing that are distinct, and the different contexts in which we experience policing that we don't usually think of as contexts in which racial profiling or police brutality takes place. And so it's been about highlighting those, documenting them, and then also really pushing the conversation, particularly as we're talking nationally about police reform and accountability, to think about how putting women of color's experiences at the center of that conversation changes the strategies and the demands that we make.
In terms of policies and recommendations that you might make, can you give our listeners one or two examples of the kind of situations or the ways that women and queer women especially might experience traditional policing and what problems you see in there.
Well, for instance, in New York City, in the case of stop and frisk, the people tend to talk about stop and frisk in New York City as an issue affecting only young black and brown men, or predominantly young black and brown men. And it's true that the number of recorded stops is lower for women of color, but the rates of racial disparity are identical. In other words, over 80% of women stopped are black and Latina. Over 80% of women frisked are black and Latina. Over 80% of women arrested are black and Latina, which correlates exactly to the disparities among men and among communities in general. And so that's just one example of ways in which people are experiencing similar problems. I think Sandra Bland's case is one where the nation sort of became aware of women's experiences of driving while black. And in New York City, of course, there's walking while black or standing while black. And so that's one way in which they're similar. But then, for instance, the stop can take a different turn for women of color. Either the offense that women are being profiled or discriminatorily targeted for is maybe a prostitution-related offense. Definitely the war on drugs is one of the primary areas in which women of color are profiled. And then there may take a different form of police harassment and abuse. It may turn very quickly to sexual harassment. Women of color in New York City, particularly young women of color, call stop and frisk, stop and grope, or stop and sexually harass. And then often it moves into extortion of sex. If you give me a blowjob, I'll tear up the summons. I won't take you in. I won't put you through the system. Or just straight up sexual assault. And so those are ways in which it takes gender-specific forms or might take place in a gender-specific context and have gender-specific consequences. For instance, if you're arrested and you're the primary caretaker of a child, if you're a woman of color, the child is likely to be left alone or put in the custody of Child Protective Services in the way that when a white woman is arrested, when that happens, that is less likely to happen. So that's kind of the overall framework that we've been trying to bring to the center. How that changes our demands is that, one, we want racial profiling statistics to be broken out by race and gender so we can see what's happening for women. I had to ask our colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights and New York Civil Liberties Union to do that data analysis because the NYPD wasn't doing it to figure out the racial disparities for women. We want to include in our profiling bans, like we do in New York City, bans against profiling based on gender as well, and gender identity and sexual orientation, as well as race and religion and national origin. And we've managed to do that now federally through the recently introduced 2015 End Racial Profiling Act. We want to look for policies around that address police sexual misconduct. The NYPD, unfortunately, still does not have a policy that prohibits sexual misconduct against members of the public. Now, they would say it's covered by courtesy, professionalism, respect, or that officers should know that already, but there's no explicit policy stating that, despite the fact that the International Association of Chiefs of Police has said that departments should have such a policy. So those are just two examples of how that changes the policy.
I would imagine, as you've suggested, when you referenced unreported incidents and statistics, it must be frightening for a woman to have been stopped and experienced inappropriate sexual behavior and then not knowing who to come forward to. How are those cases documented?
They're not. No one collects data on complaints of police sexual misconduct, except perhaps community organizations like the New York City Anti-Violence Program, for instance. It's not collected by the police department. It's not collected by the CCRB. And if IAB collects that information, we're not privy to it. So that's certainly one of the other demands that we would want. We would want policies to prevent, detect, ensure accountability for, and document police sexual misconduct.
With the newly or relatively newly created of Office of Inspector General in New York City, have you seen an improvement in policies?
They unfortunately don't make policy at the New York City Office of Inspector General, but they do do research and documentation. At this point, I've seen they've done two reports on use of excessive force. It's better than no reports on the use of excessive force. I think they found some important trends around lack of discipline, around of training, around the ways in which excessive force is taking place in New York City. One of the things we've asked them to do, for instance, is to do an audit of how policy changes we secured around interactions with LGBT people are actually being implemented. I get calls regularly talking about violations of those policies. When we ask the NYPD about it, they say, well, we've done all the training. It's like, well, clearly there needs to be an audit of how it's actually being implemented. And I think the report of the independent monitor in the stop and frisk cases released this week shows the importance of that kind of audit, right? It shows that when you do the training and you do the new forms, that you need to check and see if it's being followed on the back end. Because what the independent monitor found is that, in fact, the it's not trickling down, and it's not officers are still confused about what they're supposed to be doing, and there's still high rates of noncompliance with stop reporting, making sure you have reasonable suspicion, documenting it, supervisor signing off, et cetera. So again, it's similarly, we would like the inspector general to take a more active role in doing that kind of audit.
I wanted to ask about the Tikkun versus City of New York case, which we haven't covered in. It's about time that we do. Can you tell the audience, Andrea, what the facts and issues were? It was a really a successful impact piece of litigation. Help us understand that.
So it was a decade-long odyssey that started with the Republican National Convention in New York City in 2004. As I'm sure your listeners are familiar, there were mass arrests, and 1,800 of them or more. And my client, Caitlin Tikkun, was one of them. I was part of the Guild's sort of defense, mass defense contingent down at the courthouse. I was working with the Sylvia Rivera Law Project to make sure that particularly queer and trans folks who were arrested as part of the mass arrests were not experiencing additional violations in police custody and in court. And I met my client there who had been arrested at Union Square East along with 200 other people who were just sort of kettled into a block who happened to be there, some of them delivering Chinese food, some of them coming out from doctor's appointments. In my client's case, just sort of, oh, there's a marching band going by. Let me see what they're doing. This seems kind of interesting. And then being arrested, she was processed as a woman up until a point. Her ID says she's a woman. She identifies as a woman. There should have been no doubt or concern or question. No one said anything about anyone's safety being at risk. No one was concerned about anything. But at some point, an officer decided that they wanted to ask her questions about her anatomy, about surgeries that she'd had, etc. And she refused to answer them, saying this was not relevant to her arrest or her safety. And they took her into a private area and conducted a strip search to assign her a gender based on anatomy. They later placed her in a cell with women and continued to process her, and then she experienced some discriminatory questions and comments from officers asking her about her sexual orientation, about who she slept with, about all kinds of other things that had no business in any kind of police interaction. So we sued, claiming not only that she had been subjected to an unlawful search and discriminatory treatment as a transgender person, in addition to the false arrests and all the other claims that went along for all the RNC arrests, but that this was part of a pattern in practice on the part of the New York City Police Department in terms of not providing officers with sufficient instruction or guidance as to how to determine gender for the purposes of arrest processing and how to properly interact with LGBT people, and particularly not telling them that they shouldn't search people to assign them a gender, that the Constitution allows you to search people for weapons, evidence, contraband. There's no, you know, anatomy for gender exception to those rules. So that process sort of got bogged down in the entire RNC litigation. But in the end, sort of while that was proceeding, we compiled a comprehensive set of recommendations for changes to the NYPD patrol guide. And by we, I mean the Sylvia Rivera Law Project, the Urban Justice Center, Lambda Legal, Fierce, the New York Civil Liberties Union, the New York City Anti-Violence Program, and members of the transgender community came together. We went through the patrol guide from beginning to end. We researched policies around the country and came up with a proposal of all the changes that the NYPD needed to make in order to ensure that the rights of transgender people were not violated during police interactions. We presented it to them. Fast forward, long story, we negotiated for 18 months with them, and in June of 2012, the majority of them were adopted. That's what we need to audit, because those policy changes at the time were among the most progressive in the country. There were models used in New Orleans, in other jurisdictions around the country, LA, Chicago, et cetera, but they're not being followed here. And so we need to audit their implementation. So then that's where the inspector general comes in order to make that happen.
What are those policy changes?
They are that you need to address someone using the gender marker that they identify with. You need to use the proper honorific that goes with their gender identity. And that basically that you should treat the person, address them, and interact with them throughout the arrest processing period according to their gender identity. And if their ID says something different, then you can mark that down somewhere else on a form. But if I say my name is Andrea Ritchie and I would like you to address me as ma'am and I go by she and her, that should be the end of the conversation. If my ID matches that, great. If it doesn't, it doesn't matter. That my preferred name or the name I go by and use is the one that's used on the forms, the one that we interact with. Most importantly, my client said at the beginning of the litigation, I don't care so much about the money, although we did receive a good financial settlement. She said, I just wanted to say, in all caps, in the patrol guide, you can't search someone to assign them a gender. It now says, in all caps, in the patrol guide, you can't search someone to assign them a gender. It says that you have to house people according to their gender identity, unless they raise a safety concern or someone else does. In which case, you should house them either separately, in a special category cell, but the primary thing is about respecting gender identity and keeping people safe. Those are kind of the broad strokes of what the changes were that we asked for. Unfortunately, in the last few weeks, I've heard cases of officers asking people about their genitalia. I've heard cases of officers searching people, groping them to feel what their genitalia looks like, and then, or feels like, I assume, and then putting them in a cell that's not consistent with their gender identity. I've heard instances of officers calling people names, and this is, you know, 3 years later. So we definitely need to do something about making sure that, and I know City Council has written to the Inspector General asking for an audit. I know the LGBT advisory panel to the police commissioner has called for an audit. LGBT organizations have met with the Inspector General's office ourselves, called for an audit. And so we're hoping that that's something that CCRB will recommend, that there will be a sort of movement towards making sure this happens.
Andrea, in Ferguson, Missouri, black women were subjected to traffic stops more frequently than any other category, if you will, of motorists in 2013. In New York City, racial disparities in stops and arrests, as you've mentioned, are identical between genders. Why do you think the media and public consciousness around police misconduct continues to figure a black man at the center of this problem?
Well, I mean, I think because it's a real issue. I do feel that black men are a central target, and it's the data shows bears it out. The death toll bears it out. The mass incarceration rates bear it out. Black men are wholeheartedly at the center of the sights of the police and of mass incarceration in the criminal legal system. But we just need to expand the lens to see who else is also in the sights. And that does include black women, as I said, queer and not queer, trans and not trans. And we, part of the way to do that is to make sure the data is broken down as it was in Ferguson. The reason we know that is because in Ferguson, they break the data down not just between blacks and whites, and not just between black men and white men, but between black women and white women, black men, white men, et cetera. And so, and Latinas and Latinos, et cetera. And so I think we need that level of data disaggregation in order to see what's actually happening with women. I think then we also need to change the narrative in the public imagination. I think when the media believes that the story is, the story involved, like that Sandra Bland's story was somehow an anomaly, that somehow in this instance, a black woman got caught instead of the usual suspect. That's part of the news story around Sandra Bland is, oh, it was a black woman. I think the more, and the media is catching on, the more that we start to hear the stories of black women, the more we'll start to see them as part of this larger conversation we're having about policing. And then I think for police officers, the numbers, as I said, are recorded are smaller. And I think it's because they also don't think that when they're stopping a woman, it's a stop and frisk. They think it's another kind of police encounter because stop and frisks are about men. So I think we need to sort of change their understanding so they're marking down when they interact with women, when it's a stop, when it's a Terry stop, that they're marking those down as Terry stops and not as whatever.
That's
they're
fascinating.
Marking them down as, you know?
Almost as if the females don't count.
Well, and also if you're going to sexually harass someone, you probably don't want to fill a form
exactly.
out documenting the interaction, right? It makes it a bit easier to track
right.
you.
Let me ask this. If statistics are broken down the way you describe, for example, in Ferguson, I would imagine that means different jurisdictions may keep different statistics. Is New York in the minority, as far as you know, about not documenting that kind of race and gender stops?
In New York, they I think most jurisdictions documented. It's whether the information gets disaggregated publicly. And so I think what's unique about New York is that we've had the longest time and the greatest access to the data, thanks to litigation brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights. And so, and a data bill, you know, that New York Civil Liberties Union passed. And so I think even if the city wasn't publishing the data disaggregated by race and gender, because CCR and NYCLU had access to it, they could do it. In Ferguson, it was published that way by the Attorney General. In all jurisdictions where the data is disaggregated in that way across the country, they found identical racial disparities. So we just need more jurisdictions to be doing the number crunching
right.
to show what's happening with Black women and Latinas and Asian women and so on.
Got it.
Imagine for a moment that you were the criminal justice policy advisor to New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. What would be the top five reforms you would recommend to the mayor that would be implemented here in New York City to address the problems we've been talking about?
It's hard to narrow it down to five and hard to imagine myself in that position. But part of what makes it easier is that I have the honor and privilege of serving as the co-chair of the Criminal Justice and Anti-Violence Working Group of the New York City Council's Young Women's Initiative. So we have actually spent the last, it feels like 6 or 7 months, thinking about what our top five recommendations are to New York City Council and to the speaker around criminalization of young women and young women of color. Getting the NYPD to get a sexual harassment policy, a policy in place around detecting, documenting, preventing, and addressing and ensuring accountability for sexual misconduct, and giving the CCRB jurisdiction over those cases. So the answer to someone who's been sexually harassed by the police isn't, we're going to have to go talk to the police about it at IAB, would be one of the top five. The second would be passing the Right to Know Act. Which would require officers to give people information about who stopped them and why, which would make it a lot easier for young women who experience sexual harassment to then pinpoint who did it to them and secure accountability. It would also mean the stop and grope. If it happens during a consent search, the officer would have to say to the young woman, look, I have no basis to frisk you. I have no probable cause. I have no reasonable suspicion to believe you're armed, but I would like you to consent to a search. Do you consent? And then you have the right to not consent. And then it would require officers to secure proof of informed and voluntary consent. Well, consent searches are ways in which stop and grope happens. Consent searches are ways in which gender searches happen on the street, even though there's this prohibition against them. Officers in the street say to women all the time, lift up your shirt, open up your pants. Are you a boy or a girl? I need to know. And then the third way in which consent searches are critical to young women, for instance, is that they often uncover the presence of condoms in someone's purse or pocket, which are then used for women of color, not white women necessarily, unless they're in a particular area or perceived in particular ways, as evidence of intent to engage in prostitution, which I know you're shaking your head. Everyone I mentioned that to has that reaction to it because it really is preposterous. But it is a gender-specific form of racial profiling that happens in New York City and across the country. And consent searches are an instrumental tool to that. So the Right to Know Act would do some critical things for young women, so that on those three grounds. So those would be two demands I would make. I think the third would be to stop enforcement of low-level offenses through the criminal system. So, for instance, Saturday night, I popped out of the subway with some friends and my partner to go out in central Brooklyn. Instead, I found myself in front of 11 officers surrounding a young Black woman who was crying and weeping hysterically and hyperventilating, clearly in the midst of a panic attack, in cuffs. You know, the officers were trying to put her in the car. There was a crowd around of people saying, this is a young woman. Why are you doing this to her? This is awful. This is racist. The whole incident started over an alleged turnstile jump. That should not have been an instance where there was going to be an arrest, where there was going to be cuffs, where there had to be EMTs called because the officers, by 14 armed police officers surrounding this woman, caused her to have a panic attack. And it turns out it was her 18th birthday. She just was trying to go celebrate her birthday. Whether she did the turnstile jump or not, this should not have been the consequence. The consequence should not have been spending a night in a police precinct and possibly going to central booking. That needs to stop. There needs to be a mandate that it be a tab ticket or a summons, or frankly, we should deprioritize enforcement of low-level offenses. So ending broken windows policing would be my third recommendation to the mayor. And then I think making sure that, I mean, I think the mayor's talking about closing Rikers. I think that would be a great thing. I think the certainly the speaker of the city council is talking about it. Now, I think where people go is the question people are raising. I think that means follow the national trend towards decarceration, not just put people in other lockdown facilities that are different. And I think my fifth recommendation would be around rethinking our approaches to family violence and presence of cops in schools. It would be to take police out of schools. It would be to rethink mandatory arrest policies, because what ends up happening when police respond to a domestic disturbance is that all too often where Black women and women of color are concerned, they are just as likely to get arrested under mandatory arrest policies as they are to experience protection. And that's because of stereotypes of Black women as people who can't be victimized, who are inherently violent, who are inherently animalistic, who inherently kind of probably gave as good as they got, who, you know, and those are racial stereotypes we don't talk about when we talk about racial profiling. But that's racial profiling that happens when police respond to violence. And so Black women, there was a study done a few years ago that found that of survivors of violence who had like a track record of being the person who was experiencing domestic violence, who were arrested by police who were responding to calls for help, 80% of them were Black and Latina, again. So in cases where police show up, there's domestic violence happening, they decide to arrest a woman, 80% of the time when that happens, it's because the woman's Black or Latina. It's because police can't see them as victims of violence. They see them as someone who must also inherently be violent. And so that's an area of racial profiling that needs to be addressed, and I would really encourage the formation of a task force or something to look at mandatory arrest policies to look at how racial profiling is happening in responses to violence.
Andrea, those are phenomenal suggested reforms with which we heartily concur.
Could you explain to our audience what it was that you went to law school and you got involved in this wonderful work? What was it that got you going in doing what you're doing?
You know, I'm writing a book about, it's called Invisible No More, Racial Profiling and Police Brutality Against Black Women and Women of Color. And you know, I've just been working on the introduction and thinking about that. And, you know, I had my own experiences of police abuse as a younger person, but that isn't what started me on this path. I think as a lot of young women I just was like, oh, that's not part of this real story. And this was around the time of, you know, I came up through Rodney King. I came up through, you know, all the organizing in the 90s. And I just didn't see my story as part of that. So it turns out it wasn't my own experiences, but it was experiences of women in my community. I was actually living in Toronto at the time, and the first person I heard about who was killed by police after Rodney King, even though it happened before he was killed, was a Black woman named Sophia Cook. She wasn't killed by police, but she was shot by police and paralyzed by them, who, you know, was in a car. It was a car stop. She was sitting in the car with a seatbelt, unarmed, and was shot in the back by Toronto police and paralyzed. And again, it was about the kinds of stereotypes that say that even if you're a Black woman sitting quietly in a car as a passenger, you somehow pose enough of a threat to an officer that they have to shoot you in the back and paralyze you. And then the second story I heard about was a woman named Audrey Smith, who was a visitor from Jamaica, hanging out on a corner, a busy corner, sort of like Houston and Lafayette here, at 1 a.m. on a Saturday night. And police officers approached her, assumed that she was dealing drugs, and strip searched her in the middle of the street in a busy street corner, just like this one. And that is, unfortunately, an all too frequent kind of thing that happens in the context of the war on drugs with Black women. And so those two stories really, I realized that me and sort of my small group of friends of women of color organizers who were involved in police accountability movements were talking about those stories as alongside Rodney King's and the others. But the larger civil rights movement and police accountability movement and police misconduct movement didn't know them and weren't talking about them in the same way. And so that's what started me off on this sort of lifelong journey of uncovering, bringing to the center the unknown and untold stories and the invisible stories of police brutality and misconduct against members of Black communities, and then urging us to really think about what it requires of us to reimagine our demands and our visions for safety when we center those stories.
Andrea, it's been too long. We need to have you on more often. You're such an inspiration and really moving this issue forward quite effectively.
But before you walk out the door, Andrea, tell our listeners how they might get in touch with the organizations you work with if they want to be more of a part of this.
I recently launched a website, AndreaJRitchie.com, which has a lot of the information that we're talking about, a lot of the reports that I've been involved in writing, Say Her Name, Resisting Police Violence Against Black Women, Queer Injustice, which, as we talked about earlier, was released 5 years ago, and some other resources and reports that I've been involved in writing. I think that folks can also learn more about police violence against LGBT people and things that people are doing about it by visiting a website called getyourrights.org, and it's spelled GETYRRIGHTS. That's a network of LGBT organizations that are working on issues of policing and criminalization. And then people can also go and learn more at Insight, INCITE-NATL, National, Insight National, where there's a lot of resources around policing of women of color that I was a part of putting together, and more information there about how folks can get involved. So I'm just really grateful to Law and Disorder. I feel like you all are putting out the counter narrative, and I hope that you're feeling vindicated in this moment that people are starting to have the conversations that you've been having here and bringing to light over decades, starting to have them more broadly. So thanks for all your work. Yeah. And I also just really want to thank Catherine Franke, your newest host, for making sure that we had this conversation today. I'm sorry that she wasn't able to join us, but I look forward to continuing to hear all three of you in conversation.
Thanks, Andrea. Richie,
thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder. Good luck.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Today we explore a controversy at Harvard Law School. After a prominent law firm, Milbank Tweed, discontinued a $1 million grant it had given to the school after it learned that its donation helped pay for a panel on Palestine. We'll talk to the Harvard Law student who organized the event, who will explain how students on campuses across the nation have been met with fierce efforts to suppress discussion of Palestinian rights. Saeed, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
We understand that Milbank Tweed, a very prominent law firm in Boston and New York and across the country, or really globally, gave a substantial gift to Harvard Law School, a $1 million gift over 5 years, to support student-run events. Tell us about the event that you were involved in organizing that the Milbank money supported through the Milbank Tweed Student Conference Fund.
Sure. So this was actually the first time that our group, Justice for Palestine, used Milbank funding to organize an event in its history as an organization on campus. The event was called the Palestine Exception to Free Speech, a Movement Under Attack. We had speakers from Palestine Legal, an attorney from Palestine Legal, an attorney from Center for Constitutional Rights, and a student from Northeastern University. The attorneys spoke about a report that they had just released under the same name, The Palestine Exception to Free Speech, which documents the suppression of Palestinian advocacy nationwide, be it through donor pressure or heightened administrative scrutiny. They cited all types of different examples, including that of Stephen Salida, who was a tenured professor at the University of Illinois, whose tenure was revoked after some tweets he made that were critical of Israel.
So you had this event, what was it, last October?
Yes, this was last October.
How was the attendance?
It was packed. We had it was standing room only, at somewhere between 80 and 100.
Okay, that's great. And what did the funding cover from the Milbank Fund?
Pizza, actually. We didn't pay the speakers anything for the travel costs. They offered their time at no cost to the school. Usually at the law school, lunch events have food, and pizza is actually one of the most cost-effective.
Syed, how much did you receive specifically?
Well, we received $2,000 for the first semester. You actually apply on a semesterly basis, and so we decided to use the first $500 of that on pizza for the event.
So you buy the pizza. What happened?
You know, the event went off without a hitch. There were no disruptions. There were really no problems at the event itself. A couple of questions that were arguably a little antagonistic, but nothing out of the ordinary at all. And the following day, I received an email from the Dean of Students' Office asking me to come into the office to discuss the event. When I got there, they told me that they had been receiving a lot of phone calls and emails about the event, and that they wanted me to remove the association to Milbank from the Facebook event page, even though the event had already passed. And I don't think anyone really checks Facebook event pages after events have already passed.
Could I just ask you this? Did Milbank Tweed have its name on the Facebook page so it could get some positive recognition, like in terms of students there having a favorable opinion of Milbank, so that when Milbank comes to recruit on the campus, they got a leg up against the other international firms? Do you think that was the motivation for Milbank insisting really on getting publicity for their generosity?
Yeah, that's exactly it, actually. Sorry, I should have clarified that earlier. But when the funds are dispersed to student groups, there's an email that goes out, and in that email it gives you a little bit of logistical information on how to access the funds, and then it also reminds you that as a stipulation of receiving these funds, you are required to attribute where the funds are from, and mention Milbank by name as a sponsor, very prominently, actually. You're supposed to put it on all the flyers and any promotional material, and you're actually also supposed to put up a banner on the podium and behind the speaker that has the name of the firm.
That makes sense. If you're going to give $1 million to the law school, you'd like a little credit for it. So what happened next? You get called into the Dean of Students' office and are told to remove Milbank's name from any event that has to do with Palestine, and then what?
Yeah, so my immediate reaction was, yeah, sure, that's great. We're never really that excited about putting a law firm's name on our events in the first place, but after that, I realized, well, wait, this could have some kind of serious implications, and I asked for a guarantee that the school would never agree to a relationship with Milbank in which Milbank would have the say over what groups get their money.
Yeah, good for you.
The way it is currently, the Dean of Students' Office receives the money, and then they administer the application process, and they decide how the money is distributed. And that's actually something I asked about even before I applied. Just knowing what I know about Palestine organizing, I probably wouldn't have applied if they told me in the first place that that Milbank would be the one deciding. But they assured me that no, the school decides. So I said, okay, well, I have a good relationship with the school, with the Dean of Students' Office. Hopefully this will work, and we got the money.
So then what happened?
So sorry. After that, they sort of gave me verbal assurances that day, saying, yeah, of course, no, we would never do that, yeah. And I said, well, it would be great to get that in writing. For the next couple of weeks, I would pop into the office, I'd send emails saying, hey, still waiting on that assurance. It kind of went up the ladder from there. The dean of students would tell me, oh, yeah, sorry, I need to get that from the dean, and I haven't gotten around to it yet, and they just kind of took their time, at which point I reached out to the dean and scheduled a meeting myself. I met with the dean maybe probably three or four weeks after the event had taken place. Told her, you know, as you know, this Milbank situation happened. I'm looking for a guarantee. Can you give me that? And she told me, well, you don't have to worry about that anymore. The money is all gone for everyone. And she was actually the first person to reveal that to me back in November.
What do you mean the money's gone for everyone?
Meaning that they have pulled out all of their money. She never specified at the time whether, they were withdrawing their gifts completely from the school or just from student activities. My impression was that they had decided they no longer wanted to give any support to Harvard Law School.
So let me understand this. Milbank took back its $1 million because they were told they couldn't interfere with what the students want to use it for.
So this is what the dean told me. The dean told me that we are no longer receiving Milbank funding, so I don't need to give you this guarantee. You don't have to worry about that anymore. And now, I don't know if any of these things are true. This is what I was told. And actually, it's still unclear now that the administration has released their response and I've inquired a little further. It's still a little unclear as to what exactly has happened with the money. It's very unclear. I mean, the administration released a statement saying, no, we're still getting the money. It's just going for other purposes. But they have not made an announcement or even responded to any inquiries about where that money is going now.
Well, it sounds to me like Dean Minow worked out a compromise with the law firm that she would shift that money to other purposes, maybe scholarships or something that they would find less troubling. And I gather that she has then said she would make other funds available for the student events. Is that right?
Yeah, and that's an interesting point of contention as well. Student organizers will tell you that they don't have money this semester. Either they have no money at all or they have less money. So this claim that, oh, no, the same amount of support is available doesn't really make sense at all. To sort of try to give this impression that there was no disruption occurred, this was just sort of all a part of the plan all along, I find really disingenuous.
Well, I know Above the Law, which is a kind of yellow journalistic, if I can say, website, has written a story about this incident and said, well, you can just shake the cushions out at Harvard and come up with $200,000 a year, which in a way is funny, of course, but in a way it's not. The student groups need funding to hold these sorts of events, like your group, but many other groups on campus, and $200,000 is a lot of money, particularly over a five-year period. I'm wondering how you and your colleagues, the other students up at Harvard Law School, are thinking about the kind of irony in this case of a law firm basically attempting to censor the wide breadth of speech among students on campus, in particular in relationship to an event where you were raising that exact issue around the Palestinian exception to the First Amendment or to free speech.
Yeah, we find it kind of hilarious. And I think, I don't know if you read our original piece, but it was kind of important to us that we maintain sort of that tone of absurdity because it really is just an absurd situation. All the students I've spoken to, of course, maybe I'm a little biased. Maybe this is one of those biases. but all the students that I've spoken to agree that this is ridiculous. And normally when Palestinians are getting positive press, there's usually a strong backlash in the media. And I just really have seen very, very little of that. And I think it's kind of universally recognized that this is just absurd, certainly ironic. And the university's response has also been very disappointing, and I think most students and even media outlets have sort of seen through that.
You know, Milbank also gives money to many other law schools for student talks or series of student talks like they do at Harvard. I know we have one at Columbia Law School, and I can think of even this year a number of events that had Milbank's name on it that were of Israeli governmental officials, former members of the Israeli government, people who were scholars who were making pro-Zionist arguments in their lectures or in their talks, and Milbank didn't object to having their name associated with those issues. I can also imagine on other kinds of issues like for or against abortion rights or drone killings or the government's attempt to get Apple to open up or breach the security of our phones. These are all highly contested issues that some of Milbank's clients might have strong feelings about. Have you ever seen a firm sponsor of events at Harvard object to the content of a student event?
I have not. And you know, similarly here, I've seen Milbank's name on events related to socialism, reproductive rights, all types of things that again, could certainly be deemed controversial by clients of Milbank or otherwise. But again, it was only when the Palestine group decided to use some of the money that it became an issue, proving that point that we were trying to make that day, which is that there is a Palestine exception to free speech.
You know, you mentioned Professor Stephen Salida, who was fired after there was pressure on the University of Illinois to deny him his job. He had tenure, and they got rid of him. And that pressure was later discovered was from donors, big donors to the university. Have you been able to ascertain who was it that pressured Milbank or pressured Harvard in this situation?
I do know that it that calls were made to the school from the very top executive level at Milbank. Without going into names, I also know that there were calls from what would seem to be unaffiliated parties, not necessarily, you know, Milbank employees or Harvard affiliates. And a lot of times, these sort of this sort of backlash is activated by networks of I don't mean to sound conspiratorial, but there are groups like, for example, NGO Monitor. It is called NGO Monitor, that will monitor the activities of be it NGOs or student organizations, and then issue letters of concern or emails to mobilize a broad base of their supporters to call in and email and express concern over certain programming. So in this case, there was actually a letter from NGO Monitor to Milbank just a couple days after the event, in which they told Milbank, "We are preparing a report on this event. Could you please clarify your involvement?" And Milbank responded saying, you know, hey, we don't necessarily endorse anything. We just give money to the school, and the school decides. And then in that email, in that same letter, Milbank actually confirmed that the school had asked me to remove the association with Milbank.
Yeah, well, that leads me to a question that Catherine had posed. What would your group, like Milbank and or the law school, to do to repair this betrayal of student free speech rights?
In our original letter, we actually asked the school to sever ties with Milbank. We felt that Milbank had behaved in a way that sort of was disrespectful to the principles of academic freedom, and we stated that, you know, the law school would do well to sever its ties with Milbank completely. And we asked the school not to try to figure out a way to keep Milbank's money. It seems the school has done just that with the statement they've released, in which they say, "We have an exceptionally strong relationship with Milbank, which has acted appropriately and with the highest integrity in all respects. We look forward to continuing that strong relationship in the future." And then further above, they speak as sort of one voice. The law school and Milbank are committed to freedom of speech. And, you know, the statement is very cleverly worded, essentially confirms all of our allegations, but is worded in such a way that one could read it and say, well, hey, no, nothing wrong has happened here. What is concerning to us is that when reached out for comment, Milbank referred reporters to the law school. So, again, here they are, speaking as one. And it's sort of reminiscent of how U.S. lawmakers and presidential candidates will speak about the U.S.'s relationship with Israel, they use very similar language, exceptionally strong, you know, unbreakable bond, our strongest ally for democracy in the Middle East.
So, Saeed, as you know, I drafted a letter for law professors and students and others to sign where we expressed concern about a law firm like this withdrawing its money based on the content that it found objectionable of a student event. And I got a lot of positive response from law faculty, but a few of them said, well, can't a funder decide what kind of events it wants to fund? You know, the American Constitution Society only funds things that are pretty progressive, and the Federalist Society funds lots of events that are pretty conservative. What's wrong with an outside funder deciding in advance what kinds of events it wants to fund? Is there a way that you would regard Milbank as a different kind of case than the ACS, the American Constitutional Society, or the Federalist Society?
Well, the issue here is more so about how reliant the school was on the source of funding and how vulnerable that source of funding has been exposed to be. Sure, companies, you know, should be able to decide where their money goes, but in this case, we feel it is very noteworthy that the company was perfectly fine with the money being used for a whole range of controversial topics and panels, but the minute the Palestinian group decides to use it, that's when it became an issue.
But does it make a difference to you and your colleagues at Harvard that Milbank is one of the largest employers of you and of your classmates when you graduate? It's a quite a different situation from an advocacy organization that is not a law firm. It strikes me that a law firm has a particular kind of power,
yeah,
and power to chill speech among students when that law firm is one of the largest employers of the graduates of Harvard Law School. So I know at Columbia, I've already started to hear from students who've said, I got to be careful what I say, that law firms will not want to hire me if I speak out on issues having to do with Palestine.
And the problem I also see is that an academic institution is very different from the Constitution Society because it's supposed to be an environment that fosters the exchange of differing viewpoints.
Exactly. That's right.
Thank you so much for talking to us here at Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Thank you,
and
Saeed.
Good luck with your excellent work, Saeed.
Good work.
Thank you.
Take it easy.
Want to hear Law and Disorder again? Go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.